2015 and 2016, PNG was affected by widespread drought and frost, severely impacting food production in the country. In August 2017, Australia's response to the drought was evaluated by an independent consultant for DFAT. In this first section of the PNG Aid Evaluation Forum, the evaluation was presented and its findings, robustness and implications discussed by an expert commentator. Keep listening to hear their analysis.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. We've got a packed schedule, so we do need to start on time. Thanks, everyone, for coming. It's great to see such a good turnout on what some might consider a kind of obscure, fairly specialised sort of set of topics. But yeah, one of our core interests at the Development Policy Centre is aid effectiveness, and another of our core interests is Papua New Guinea development. And when we saw a number of evaluations have been done all on PNG, you know, we thought this is a really good opportunity to go over the issues, dig a bit deeper into what's happening with the Australian aid program in PNG. I'm a real believer we can learn a lot about aid by looking at aid evaluations. We don't normally take them seriously enough. And this is our attempt to really capitalise on some of the great material that DFAT and ODE are putting out in terms of evaluation. So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. Before we begin, let's acknowledge the first Australians, the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting, and let's pay our respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. Just a few special welcomes. I'd like to thank Daniel Sloper and Peter Vasigi from DFAT for coming and for listening to what everyone has to say. And, of course, please do participate in the Q&A, and we'll give you a chance at the end to set us straight. I would like to thank Senator Claire Moore for making time in her very busy schedule for becoming the Shadow Minister for the Pacific and Development. I'm going to ask Wendy Jarvi, who's the Adjunct Professor of the School of Business, UNSW, Canberra, to give us some opening remarks. But just before you come up, Wendy, I'm going to make some pre-opening remarks. Basically, we've got these three evaluations, and we've got the same format for each. So we're going to have the author of the evaluation present it, and then we're going to have a discussant. And the discussant's meant to talk about the evaluation, its credibility, its usefulness, its findings, its recommendations. Perhaps a DFAT response. Each of those is only meant to be 15 minutes, and we will be keeping time. So I've asked Shannon to give you reminders, and we will cut you off when your time's up. And then after each of the two, we'll ask them to sit down, and we'll have 15 minutes for discussion. And we'll do, after the second one of those, we'll have a break, and we'll have morning tea. It should be served outside, and then we'll resume for the third one and for some closing remarks from Daniel, I think. Or Daniel and Peter. I'm going to chair it. It's a pretty informal event, so, do participate. I'm going to chair it, but it's a pretty low-key chairing. I'm also a speaker at one stage. So I'm just going to run through the introductions now, because then we can just, we don't need to have separate introductions. I think most of you will know most of the speakers, but just to go through them in order, Bernard Broughton is the author of the evaluation of the Australian aid response to the PNG drought. And he's an independent consultant with massive experience, including, interestingly, he was on the evaluation of the previous drought in PNG, which was in 1997. So he's got a very interesting perspective. And then the discussant of that will be Mike Burke. Mike's a colleague here at the ANU and, has a real leading expert on PNG agriculture, also involved in the drought response, probably both drought responses. Yeah. David Slattery is the author of the roads support evaluation. He's with ODE. He's done a lot of work on aid evaluation, starting with the audit office, as I remember, about a decade of experience, I think, and shortly heading off to the UNDP. We're glad you could make it before you go. Yeah, I'm going to speak on that roads evaluation. And then the final one, we've got Ian Anderson. He was the author of the health evaluation, which is the multilateral support to the health sector. Ian is has a lot of experience with AusAid. ADB is a health specialist, focuses on the Pacific, and is completing his doctoral studies on Pacific health policy at the ANU. And then the final discussant, it's Colin who just walked in. Yeah. So Colin's like a younger version of Ian. Also a lot of AusAid experience, a lot of health experience in PNG, did his PhD rural health systems in PNG and still works on service delivery in PNG based in the Department of Pacific Affairs here at the ANU. So yeah, we've got a great set of speakers. To kick us off, I asked Wendy Jarvie to give us the opening remarks. Wendy's got a lot of evaluation experience herself. She's based at UNSW here in Canberra. She's an adjunct professor at the School of Business. But also, Wendy is on the Independent Evaluation Committee that oversees all the ODE evaluations. She's been doing that job since 2012. And so I thought it'd be great to have someone from IEC to kick us off. So please welcome Wendy Jarvie.
Great, thanks for that introduction, Stephen. And first of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners, the Ngunnawal people, on the land on which we meet today, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. I'm really pleased to be here today, and I'm really pleased to see so many people here. Stephen, this is a great idea. You know how important we think this is. As Stephen said, I'm a member of the Independent Evaluation Committee, and I've been there, and I can't believe it's been 6 years. It's a long time. And our job is to oversight the quality, credibility and independence of ODE evaluations, the Office of Development Effectiveness Evaluations. So the IEC has been strongly supportive of these seminars. They've been doing them for how many years have you been doing them with ODE? They've been doing them jointly with ODE for years, where ODEs... evaluations have been subject to this sort of scrutiny, but this is really the first time that you've really properly opened it up so that the public, so that the program evaluations are getting the same level of scrutiny and engagement as the ODE evaluations. Anyway, we see this as a really important part of enhancing the quality, the methodological robustness of evaluations, and also about their credibility, because evaluation's no use if it's not credible. It can't play an important role in the accountability function at all. If it's not credible. So credibility to us is really, really important. And I want to thank the program managers for coming here today. And I should say that this is really quite a difficult thing for program managers to expose their programs, to do evaluations, to publish them, and then to come to a forum like this. And I know this because in my former life, I was a bureaucrat. My very first job as a branch head was in charge of an evaluation area. And I struggled getting evaluations published. Kim, you remember this. We struggled, and the penny finally dropped when I was in a deputy secretary's office. I'm a little branch head, young, and in my deputy secretary's office, and he said to me, "Wendy, you are trouble." And he intimated that the evaluations that were in his bottom drawer of his filing cabinet were never going to see the light of day, because I was trouble. And at this point, I thought I didn't have a very long career looking at me, you know. I did. I stayed for 20 years. But I did take a move very shortly afterwards doing higher education policy, which I can tell you, working with universities, vice-chancellors and academics is easy compared to doing evaluations in the public service and getting them out. Things have changed, though. Things have changed. And I have to say, I am really impressed with DFAT and what it has tried to do, its commitment to doing a comprehensive evaluation program in the aid area and publishing the results and then coming along here. But I know it's not easy, because public servants want things to be perfect, and no human activity is ever perfect. And it's easy to focus on the things that don't work rather than things that do and what you can learn from them. Anyway, I just want to take two more things because I haven't had my... She's getting ready to tell me to leave. The three reports we're talking about today are really important. They're really important parts of the work, the DFAT program, with working with the PNG government in roads, drought and health, really important, so it's great. But it's a very challenging country. It's a wonderful country. It's a complex country. It's a challenging country. And it'd be easy to focus on the challenges of working in PNG, but I'd really like to focus on the evaluation and the evaluation results, and in particular, evaluation use. Frankly, I don't think... Evaluation's important for accountability? Absolutely. It's an important part of meeting, DFAT meeting the PGPA Act. Absolutely. But the real value for money, I got value for money in there, the real value for money is if their evaluation results are used. Not immediately, it mightn't be immediately, it might be down the track, but they've got to be used. Otherwise, they're not worth anything. So I'll be interested in what the program managers tell me about how they've changed or how they're thinking about changing what they do. And evaluations can be very transformative. Have I got 1 minute? 2 minutes? Right. And evaluations can be transformative if they're used well. I work also as an education consultant to the World Bank in the Pacific. I do reading. I've been working reading programs, and there's a wonderful example of a World Bank Read PNG program. To cut a long story short, they did it properly. They rolled out a reader boosting program in one province. They did the proper thing. It was a randomised control trial. Wonderful, wonderful thing. And they knew immediately it wasn't working. They didn't throw it out. They went back. They looked really closely at what they were doing. They transformed what they did it in the Western Highlands, and boy, we've had the best results and improvements in reading that I've seen virtually anywhere because they took time to learn what went wrong before. So that's what I want to focus on. And I had one very last thing. David is leaving. Where are you, David? It's been wonderful working with you. You've been an incredibly important part of ODE transforming its and lifting its quality, its influence, and we're going to miss you. Anyway, over to everybody else. Thanks.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Wendy, for that, those insights and encouragement. It's good you mentioned the three evaluations. I was going to say a few words about it, but I think you've covered it. I mean, we just picked these three because I think they are the three evaluations that have been done on PNG, in the PNGA program the last few months. I think they're all self-evidently important, so I'll leave any other comments on the projects to the evaluators and the discussants. And I'd now like to call on Bernard Broughton to kick us off with the drought evaluation.
Good morning. I'm a bit nervous about this because it's a PowerPoint presentation and I've never been very good at getting them really, really crisp and clean. There are 14 pages. Hopefully we won't drown in the process. Just before I do this, I think the reason this is important is because in a very sort of a simplistic way, and this goes back to 97 as well, what Australia did in 97 in response to that drought. Our way of operating, the government's way of operating, is essentially to be seen to be helpful and not to upset the apple cart, not to get into any conflict with the government. And that's okay as long as people's lives aren't really at risk. Now, there's a big question mark here about how many people died, what was the excess mortality. But my point is that as long as you can get away with it, that being seen to be helpful and not doing a great deal, I'm not trying to undermine what was done, but in monetary terms and in terms of the amount of food lifted and that sort of thing, these are fairly modest contributions, both in 97 and more recently. In fact, it was more in 97. More money was spent in 97. But these are fairly minimalist approaches, and minimalist approaches will not cut it if you really do get a raging emergency. And what concerns me is that unless people look at what it really would take to respond really well to a humanitarian emergency, unless people figure that out, it might come to pass one time that it's not okay just to take a minimalist approach and try and get through with not upsetting the government and just being seen to be helpful. The scope of the evaluation. The focus was Australia's response from September 15 to June 17, and that included a package of assistance, as it was called, which was just under 8 million. The largest investments, I'm only going to list four of them, there were 12. The largest were firstly mainly through the Humanitarian Partnership Agreement to CARE, Oxfam and World Vision for various response, recovery and resilience activities, mainly in the Highlands. It was 3.3 million. $1.5 million for logistics support. That included airlifting some rice out of Hagen in warehouses that were stuck there, basically, into Oxapen. It also included paying for coastal shipping of rice that had been donated by Okteti Development Foundation to Western Province, and then from Western Province flying some of that out to Moorhead and Barmu. A bit over $1 million to the Church Partnership Program for recruiting and paying the salaries and costs of disaster response coordinators for each of the seven mainline churches and for an overall coordinator. And finally, just under $1 million to the Research Institute, to mainly for planting materials and seeds for agricultural recovery and resilience, the National Agricultural Research Institute. So that was the scope. The evaluation questions that were agreed with DFAT, I'll start with two because my presentation starts with two. Was Australia's humanitarian assistance well planned and efficient? Was it appropriate, timely and effective? And did it contribute to resilience and national and local leadership and capacity? The primary limitation of the evaluation was that you rely a lot on reports from implementing partners, as they're called, and things like the AQC, DFAT's AQC. And the evidence for those reports, it was very uncertain, but at the same time, it was very difficult to get primary evidence to sort of triangulate and figure out how much of that was basically a good news story and how much of it was real. I was only able to go to three locations. And I mean, to be honest, it's very difficult to do these exercises in like a three-week turnaround after the event. Anyway, we'll start with the impacts very simplistically. There was reduced rainfall from April 2015, which was largely forecast already by BOM some months earlier, and drought took hold. There was subsequently reduced cloud cover in high-altitude locations in July, August, and that led to damaging frosts. The impacts on the population included reduced access to clean drinking water and staple foods and health problems, and some displacement, particularly in Western Province. Now, although there is conflicting evidence and insufficient data to quantify this, there must have been increases in all-causes mortality, because the health status of many of those affected would have deteriorated, making them more vulnerable to morbidity and mortality. This is a contentious point. The government maintains there were very few deaths that you could relate to the drought. On the other hand, some people have estimated much, much larger figures in hundreds and thousands. As an evaluator needing evidence, all I've been able to conclude and put in the report is that there's no way that there would not have been an increase in mortality. But quantifying that is impossible. And by the way, it's not just PNG. Most places that I've worked in emergencies, people measure things like global acute malnutrition, but excess mortality is not something that's normally estimated. Problematic, to say the least. Assessment shortcomings. These are assessments of the needs in 2015. Neither the government nor the international community should have tolerated the degree of uncertainty about the seriousness and specificity of the impacts. It's not that people weren't trying to figure out what had happened. NGO and church assessments in particular were valuable, but they were localised and they begged further assessment. It was very unlike, I've worked a lot in Africa, and in Africa you have these sort of well-oiled machines of assessment that are, whether through NGOs like MSF or UNICEF or somebody, you'd normally expect much more assessment than was done in PNG. There was a very high underlying wasting rate, has been for a long time, of course, in PNG. And the reports of drought-related mortality, because there were reports, credible reports, following sphere standards, international norms, those two things would have triggered rapid food security and nutrition assessments according to certain practice, good practice. That didn't happen. Why the UN didn't do that, I'm not sure. Although it wasn't any substitute, the government was very quick to field teams to conduct a basic crop damage assessment. It was a bit more than crop damage assessment, but that was really the core of it. Unfortunately, the release of the reports was delayed. The methodology used overstated food aid needs, and the estimates, if you added up all the spreadsheets, it would have been 48,000 metric tonnes. Even a half, possibly even a quarter of that would be impossible to fund and distribute in PNG. While it was positive that the government took the lead, it had the effect of inhibiting a more collaborative and more rigorous assessment. You know, DFAT was very sensitive about treading on the government's toes and thus sort of saying, no, we've got this in hand. The government's own response, rice was purchased. The quantity, though, was unknown, and it was channeled through MPs. It was highly politicised, without reference to the NDC or pretty much without reference to local authorities. It's unclear what was distributed and where it was distributed, and there were lots of complaints of distributions being politicised. There was also the authorisation by government to use DSIP funds, up to $2 million for each district. That had the effect of contradicting the whole concept of focusing on Category 4 and 5 districts, of course, and the Highlands. The common practice, apparently, according to people I interviewed, was to distribute 10 kgs of rice per family. That's less than enough for a week at, if you do the math on standards. And that's nutritionally meaningless. And this is one of the things that's most notable about all of this, that food aid in PNG seems to be a sort of a window dressing exercise. People are happy to receive it and clamour to get it, but it is actually nutritionally insignificant. You don't keep people alive by giving them a week's ration of only carbohydrates. And preparedness for future emergencies has to include agreeing on evidence-based thresholds for food relief, a more targeted approach, that's problematic, of course, and a commitment to apply some form of political leadership so that there's a communication about what people are trying to do. Evaluation question one, was it well planned and efficient? Not really, despite the early warning that the drought might even be more severe than 97. It took DFAT some months to focus on the crisis, and along with other donors, the bulk of assistance, over 80%, was delivered in 2016 and 2017. So it was very late. The most consequential delay was the HPA funding, which was discussed from September but not given to NGOs until January. There were lots of confounding factors, of course, including those uncertainties I've already mentioned, sensitivities in the relation between Australia and PNG, and the fact that the government did not request assistance. That's a big one. That makes it very problematic. But these circumstances and other permutations like it could and should have been anticipated. The rating I gave for that less than satisfactory quality overall for planning and efficiency. Contingency and scenario planning. Post's initial plan assumed the assistance would be welcomed by the government and that they would have advisors in NDC. That should have been treated as high risk. It didn't happen, and I would have thought it would be unlikely that it was going to happen. A proper planning process would have addressed the strong resistance to assistance scenario. That should have been one of three top scenarios considered, but it wasn't. When the assistance options were put together in August, there wasn't a process for kicking that around within the department to figure out what were the risks, what were the assumptions, what could go wrong, and if we're, you know, basically from what I got from Post was everybody was bent over backwards not to upset the government. That's fine, but at what point does that start to compromise your ability to satisfy humanitarian imperatives? You've got diplomatic imperatives, you've got humanitarian imperatives. There was also insufficient analysis of the likely protection, gender equality and disability inclusion constraints. Was it appropriate and effective? From a diplomatic risk perspective, yes, it was. Government was quite happy. From the perspective of Australia's role as a member of a team and its contribution, Australia was very engaged, and Australia was the biggest contributor, albeit modest, really, in the scheme of things. That rates adequate quality. From an investment perspective, that is the projects, most were appropriate, although there were notable omissions. There was no funding for food aid, for example. The quality of the investments ranged from adequate to poor. I'm being told to stop, so. From a humanitarian advocacy perspective, while there's no evidence that diplomatic imperatives interfered, when I say no evidence, I was given access to the cables. The cables didn't say, you know, doesn't matter what happens, we don't want to upset the government. It was nothing like that. On the other hand, though, it's a reasonable assumption, because it was known, the bishops were complaining about the politicisation of aid. It was known to be ineffective. Basically, it was largely known to be corrupt at the local level in the use of food, and yet nothing was said. Now, of course, the government would say, well, of course we couldn't, it would have upset the government. My whole point about planning is you need to go into this understanding this dynamic and think, how are we going to manage this? We know very well we don't want to upset our partner, but at the same time, we do have humanitarian imperatives, and so it behoves us to go into this figuring out, whether directly or through partners like the UN and other the US government, other governments, the New Zealand government, how do we go into this knowing that we have to somehow square this circle of diplomatic on the one hand and humanitarian on the other? I'm going to have to stop. But I have to have this last one. From the perspective of the reasonable expectations of the affected communities, less than adequate quality. Now, this is a bit unusual. I mean, if you use an AQC format, you've only got one chance to have a look at, well, if you've got appropriate and you've got effective. And I've split it because I think you have to disaggregate the diplomatic perspective right down to the community's expectations. And basically, the community's expectations were that something would be provided in good time. And most of what was provided was not. It was provided very late, including the food that was shipped around. And the food that was shipped around, funded by DFAT, was on average, I think it was 11 kilos per person. Now, again, this comes back to the nutritionally insignificant point I made before, that it's a lot of heat and effort and planes taking off and landing, but at the end of the day, providing a ration for somebody for 11 days is insignificant. It's meaningless. It sounds good, it looks good, and the people that know that it's no good are the people on the ground, and those that I interviewed said, basically, this was too little too late. Okay.
Is there any other wrapping up point?
Well, I'll just flick through the appropriateness of the individual investments. They've all been rated, and you'll see there that they have adequate overall, but barely. Some are better than others on appropriateness. If you come to effectiveness, which is more important, I suppose, with the NGOs, the response work was solid. The recovery and resilience work was typically not. And that's because basically you can't change behaviours about feeding practices and use of water sources in an emergency. You know, this is the problem with the whole idea of doing, it's nice to do all of these things together, but if you're saying to mothers, you need to change the feeding practices that you're currently using and your grandmother was using, and here's a half day or 2 hour workshop in a different language, you know, it's like, what are you going to do? So it's very attractive to not just do relief, but to do these activities, or to try and introduce a new improved variety of seed or something like that. It's just not tenable, however. The CPP coordination was a modest investment, but a good one. NARI, not so good at all. Anyway, I won't go through the details, but it's very mixed. Did we contribute to resilience and national leadership and capacity? Overall, it's rated less than adequate quality, but recognising that the national government didn't give DFAT much room. I mean, it's a bit hard to build capacity when they're basically saying, we've got this in hand, you stay over there, do a little bit of this. So it's no surprise that there was not much left, not much opportunity. And at the end of the day, PNG is left at best very, very marginally more resilient than you found it. I mean, there's really little change. Recommendations to DFAT, there are seven of them, all of which have been accepted, which is great, and they all have to do with contingency planning and the planning process, squaring the diplomatic and humanitarian imperatives, agreeing on thresholds for response. One of the things about better assessments is being able to be confident to say, don't do it. Don't get involved in food aid because it's not going to be possible to do this credibly in some areas, but in other areas it might be. But I'm not saying never do it, but one of the reasons for better assessment is not just to wind, you know, to crank up a big food aid monster. It's to be able to say, no, we know how to tame this monster and target in certain areas. DFAT needs to advocate for the assessments that weren't done this time. The phase categorisation that was used in 97 and again in 2015, 2016, I've discussed this with Mike, that could be more, could follow better international practice. There needs to be more longitudinal data collection. And that's it.
Excellent. Sorry to rush you. I'm sure we'll come back to the other points of discussion, Mike. I'll make up for lost time.
Thanks, Stephen.
I'll look at your PowerPoint.
Yeah, thanks. I'd echo Wendy's opening comments. Congratulate DFAT for going out there, particularly a bunch of academics and consultants, very good at criticising, very poor at offering solutions. So it's great, it's good. Bernard's done a great report. He's really brought in a lot of stuff. As you said, it's difficult coming in late to this. You get paper, you get conflicting advice, you get all sorts of stuff. So my perspective is somewhat different from Bernard's, and you might think I'm being very critical of what he's done. I'm not. I think he's done a great job. I'd say that again, he's done a tremendous job. But I was very engaged with this. It's very good having someone like Bernard that has much more international experience. I spent the last 48 years working in Papua New Guinea. That's what I do. No, better than anyone else on the ground, but I don't know the biggest picture stuff, so it's good. Does this matter? Is this important? We have a drought. A couple of million people are short of water. That ranges from mild inconvenience to women working harder to people who are sick. That closes a very high proportion of the schools and for 4, 5, 6 months in the second half of 2015, hundreds of thousands of children don't go to school. Most of them go back to school after the rain comes at the end of 15, but some of those, some thousands of children don't go back to school because the schools are closed, the teachers are left. People died. Bernard and I would disagree about the numbers a bit. They died. They died in some thousands. More importantly than the people who died, or as well as we should say, are the children who will never get their intellectual potential, that first 1,000 days from conception to age two. We know it happened when the Germans took all the food out of Holland in 1944, Christmas 44. They took the food out. The Dutch starved. The Dutch loved the Yanks because the Yanks came in with the big aeroplanes and bombed them with food. Everyone said Mum suffered. Mum was okay. Mum suffered, but the kids were okay. Half a century later, there's a huge spike in the death rate in Holland. The kids weren't okay. It hits you later. It won't hit Papua New Guineans half a century later because they're all dead by the time they're 60 in these remote places, but it'll hit them 30, 40 years later. So it matters. A couple of quick slides from a colleague of mine, Sally Lloyd, colleague of ours. Sally's up there at the moment, earthquake stuff, marvellous lady, Australian, but born and bred in PNG. This is from Nomad Area, Nomad LLG. Basically, go to Cape York Peninsula, head up a bit east of north for a couple of hundred kilometres, or alternatively, you can fly into the nearest public airstrip and walk for 8 or 10 days and you get to these places. Lots of malnourished kids. This little lad was brought in, he was fainting. He actually recovered. I've seen photographs of him. He recovered. That lad's probably about 5 years old. He recovered. That lady, Margaret Hagerby, walked for 2 days to give birth at the clinic where Sally was. The son survived, the daughter didn't. Mum is too weak to see the daughter being buried, so that's why Sally took that photograph, just to show her mum. This bloke here was out getting sago. Like a lot of people who died in the drought, he dropped dead suddenly, fairly common report. If you look at the colour of his hair, it's black. You'll see some more photographs, look at their hair. In other words, they're not in their 40s and 50s when people die in these sort of lowland, remote environments. They're dying in their 20s and 30s. That's not normal, aside from women dying in childbirth. Men don't die in their 30s normally. Here's a few that Sally put together. So when Bernard and I are arguing about numbers, she's saying, well, actually, these are faces. These are friends of hers, people she knows. Look at that lady there. You'll see these people, their ribs are sticking out. There's no fat left on them. So they're just a couple of images, just to show that it's real. Turning to the assessment and Bernard's comments, the assessments were done, a number of national level assessments were done. One was done by Geoscience Australia, that was funded by DFAD. Myself and some colleagues from ANU, we did another one, frustrated that no one was doing it, so we brought all together a lot of data. My telephone bill was running at $1,000 per month at that stage. It was done by telephones and emails, essentially into networks. Another one was done by the World Food Programme, they using telephones. Couple of points here. First of all, you can get this information. You don't have to run around the bush. Oh, sorry, the NDC, National Disaster Centre, did an assessment in a very charitable way. We could call it preliminary. We could call it other things if we're less charitable. One of those assessments, and one only, was funded by DFAT. That was the GA one, the Geoscience Australia. Bernard was quite kind to him in his assessment. Essentially, it was not only a waste of time. All they did was show a map, of a very poor map, of where the grasslands of Papua New Guinea are. It was a bit worse than that, because Papua New Guineans saw what it was. It was boomerang aid. That's the Papua New Guinea term they use. It was money coming back to Australia, and the Papua New Guineans resent that. So that was a waste of money. The other two assessments, our one and the World Food Programme, they essentially overlapped. They're about 75-80% agreement. And they were tested in the field. There were still some places that fell through the gaps. Turning to the recovery phase, logistics. Yeah, Bernard's talked about logistics. He talked about he's flagged the very small quantities that DFAD paid for to get up to Oxapmin. Basically, the money that DFAD spent on transport was not wasted, but the money they spent on the Australian consultants and the whole exercise, a very expensive way of doing it. From my perspective, DFAT in post has got two options in future, not doing what they did this time, which is do it in-house. You either use the expertise in-house in Canberra, the humanitarian section, you listen to your colleagues in Canberra, and you bring in expertise you don't have, and particularly from outfits like Care Australia and others, Care International. The alternatives, you do what the Yanks and the others do, you give the money to someone else and say, you do it. There's our 8 million, there's our 2 million, you go and do it because that's what you do and you do it well. If you're going to do it in-house, you have to bring in expertise when it comes to delivering food. And far as recovery goes, once there's a National Agricultural Research Institute went to the national government and said, we need 2 million kina, it's about a million Aussie, they knocked them back. They went to DFAD. DFAD went back to two reviewers, and the reviewers said, watch these blokes, they'll knock off the money and not do much. You really need to put an Australian there, one of the reviewers said, to keep an eye on them, and you need to bring all the other institutes together under your $1 million you're going to give them. DFAD gave them the $1 million, ignored the advice of the reviewers, and the National Agricultural Research Institute did just that. They took the money, they delivered enough sweet potato for, this is 1.2 or 1.4 million households, enough sweet potato to plant half a hectare, enough planting material of cassava to plant a quarter of a hectare, enough maize to plant about half of this room. It was a joke. So they did their $1 million, and I didn't even know it was happening until someone said, by the way, it wasn't someone, lots of people in that... what's called a food security cluster, which was set up by the UN, and a lot of people there saw these presentations and said, this is a joke, you know, no one's given us $1 million Australian, and these guys have done nothing for it. So it wasn't DFAD that blew the money, but DFAD did not follow it up, and they did not put an Australian in close to it. For the future, you can either do it that way again, keep your faith in government and try and give money to the government institutions, but bringing in the other institutions, Fresh Produce Development Agency, parts of National Department of Agriculture. The alternative is you go out to the small-scale private sector.
blokes out in the village with a dirty pair of shorts and an old ute and a telephone and not much more, growing a bit of corn, pottering along. You help them with their corn, sweet potato and potato. There's only three things to worry about. Corn is by far the most important, but it only grows up to 2,200, 2,300 metres. So above that, you want potato, English potato, and then sweet potato. These are fast-growing crops. They potter along, they make a few bob, but when a crisis comes, you come in with the money. The money can come from the corporate sector, it could come from the bilateral donors or the UN system, and you say to those folk, what do you need? Well, I need some irrigation, I need a tractor, done. There's your money. 6 or 7 out of 10 will deliver, and then you buy it from them and you push it out in a hurry. Now, just to give you a sense of time, this drought, as Bernard said, starts in April 15, the frost in the middle of the year. The food actually doesn't get delivered for a year after the drought starts. But the rain comes in November 15. So from November 15, it's raining. From then, you can plant. And if this large quantities of maize, tons and tons and tons, it has to come locally. It can't come from Australia or New Zealand or even Indonesia. It has to be the right type of maize, open pollinated, right varieties. If that was there, you wouldn't have had to deliver most of that food. You wouldn't have needed that food, the $13 million that the Americans put up. Bernard used the said then at the post, he got the sense they bent over backwards, they didn't want to upset the government. That's what Australia did. They did not want to upset the government. Bernard uses some diplomatic language in his report. He talks about the prevailing political and logistic constraints, minus China, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what it is, the hubris of the PNG government, the Prime Minister, whatever it was, some combination. But the UN did not do that. Unusually, the head of the UN mission went out and he went up there and he pushed it and he pushed it and he pushed it right up until he finally got the Prime Minister to, he didn't say yes, but he stopped saying no. And at that stage, the UN said, we're going to take that as good enough as a yes. They got the 13 million and then they started distributing food well over a year after the drought had started and well after the death rate was dropping by then. Just in passing, Bernard mentioned cash vouchers. He only mentioned in passing at the time. Post was dead opposed to it. It was put up by groups, I think it was the Humanitarian Group, another group of DFAT in Canberra. I agree with Post at the time, but I think Bernard's right. You've got to look at that. Yes, it doesn't work when you're 8 days' walk from the nearest shop, but 80% of Papua New Guineans are not 8 days' walk from the nearest shop. They're less than half a day from a road, and I think cash vouchers give people the choice. I think that's something worth looking at. I'm not going to talk about the recommendations that Bernard put up. I think I've got no argument with any of them. I think they're all sound. He does criticise to some degree the work that my colleagues, myself and ANU, did, and also to a lesser degree what World Food Programme did in our methodology. Those criticisms are good. They need to be taken on board and we need to move on. We developed them under pressure. In this situation, they built on what we did back in 97, 98, but more needs to be done just to refine that. So that was useful comments from Bernard there. So look, I'll leave it at that, but again, thanks Bernard, you've done a great job, and also thanks to DFAD for exposing themselves and putting it out there. Thanks.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea, the Pacific and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter to get all the latest updates, or you can connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.